Welcome back to the Daily Drama on WHUR, Sirius XM, Channel 141, 96.3 HD2, and 98.3 FM. This is the Insight segment. I'm Harold Fisher. We are at the Reporters Roundtable tonight with some of the top stories of the week on deck. President Biden and his ongoing battle with the GOP, West Virginia Senator Joe Manchin, and the For the People Act, and the latest report on the January 6th insurrection. Also, Virginia's Democratic primary, and of course, the attack of the cicadas. My guests are Eva McKinn, congressional reporter with Spectrum News, and Misha Green, D.C. editor with the Afro-American Newspapers. Lines are open at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Also joining us tonight for the first time is Mark Fisher with the Washington Post, senior editor with the Washington Post. If you have a comment, if you have a question, give us a call at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Eva, thanks for being on the program again.
Oh, thanks for having me, Harold.
Absolutely. And Mark, thank you for joining the program.
It's an honor to be with you, Harold.
Thank you. So, Eva, let me first start with you. What on earth is going on with President Biden and the GOP? Is this just a redux of what we saw during the Trump administration when Democrats said that they were not going to support any of President Trump's policies? And of course, we remember when President Obama was in office, the GOP not supporting any of his policies. Is this political? Is this personal? What do you think?
Well, I think that members of both parties saw benefits in getting a bipartisan infrastructure deal. When we talk about infrastructure, this translates to projects in both the Democratic and Republican members' districts. They have something to show for all of this money. But ultimately, they cannot seem to come to an agreement on how to pay for it. You know, this money, unfortunately, is not just going to fall from the sky. There has to be a way to pay for it. And President Biden, the administration, Democrats, they want to use raising taxes as the vehicle to pay for it. And that is something that Republicans just will not get behind. And that's why we saw these negotiations crumble. President Biden now continuing to speak with a smaller group of Republicans and Democrats, a bipartisan group, to still try to make this happen. But this group doesn't have the blessing of Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell. It doesn't appear to have the blessing of McConnell, whereas Shelley Moore Capito of West Virginia, she was directed or encouraged to have these negotiations by McConnell. And so it doesn't seem like we're going to get a deal from this bipartisan group, and the Democrats will ultimately end up having to go at it alone.
Mm-hmm. Mark, let's talk about this from a foundational level, because President Trump, he campaigned on, among other things, a infrastructure bill. Well, we never saw that. And now we have this issue back and forth on Capitol Hill. But for John and Jane American, we know we need bridges. We know we need better roads. We know we need all kinds of infrastructure. And the reality is, if we talk about the brass tacks, it's not just the roads and the bridges, but those food trucks and those restaurants and those other businesses that will contribute to the periphery of these infrastructure monies that could come in. So why can't we get it done?
That is a great question, and I think the answer is that wanting something done and being willing to pay for it are very different things in American politics. So I think what you're going to see here when there is an ultimate deal, and I think there will be a deal, is that one side is going to have to give on the question of, do we pay for this with tax money right now or in the near future, or do we do what the Republicans want, which is to kick the can down the road and pay for it 6, 8, 10, 15 years down the road? In other words, pass the debt on to the next generation, which is what we've essentially been doing with every major spending package that has been passed in the last decade or more. So the Biden folks are coming into this saying, we want to reset here and actually start paying for things that we need. And the Republicans are saying, no, we don't like to do that. So, but I think there will be a deal because the needs are so pressing. As you mentioned, roads and bridges are the obvious parts of infrastructure. But even Republicans are now expanding their definition of infrastructure to include broadband, energy, some of these things that are not traditional brick-and-mortar kinds of infrastructure. But of course, the Democrats want to expand that definition even more to include veterans hospitals and daycare centers and places like that. That part, I think they're going to have to get done on a Democrats-only one-party vote, but there's still plenty of demand for a bipartisan deal, and I think they're going to get there. The question will be whether 10 or 20 Republicans can get past their own leadership in Mitch McConnell, who will stand athwart any deal.
Yeah, it seems that the minority party, whichever it happens to be, these folks would oppose milk chocolate if the opposing party decided that they wanted to support it. It just seems so personal. It seems so political. And Eva, so many Americans, I would argue, feel like their tails are just swinging in the wind right now, waiting for things to get right on Capitol Hill.
Absolutely. And I did wonder throughout this entire episode if Republican leadership, so not sort of more rank and file Republican members that were doing the negotiations like Senator Capito of West Virginia that I mentioned, but I did wonder if Senator McConnell, for instance, did he really want a bipartisan deal? You know, that is something that ultimately makes President Biden look good, makes the administration look good. And I wonder if there is a calculation among Republican leadership that not having a deal would be politically better for them in 2022 because they could say, oh, well, look, the Democrats, look, President Biden, they don't do anything. And so I did wonder behind the scenes, was that also a calculation in not wanting the administration to get this bipartisan victory?
Yeah.
Even though they said that they had interest in an infrastructure deal that stuck with the traditional definition of infrastructure.
202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. We are at the Reporters Roundtable talking about some of the top stories of the week. If you have a comment, if you have a question, give us a call. Eva, I want to start with you on this particular issue, these voting rights bills. A lot of people are quite familiar, even peripherally, with the John Lewis Voting Rights Act. But this For the People Act, not so much. What's the difference, and what does this have to do with West Virginia Senator Joe Manchin?
Yeah, the For the People Act is a much larger sweeping voting rights bill. The John Lewis Voting Rights Act speaks of one particular issue. For the People Act, we're talking about expanding voting rights, changing campaign finance laws. It is a massive bill. It is every Democratic voting priority of the last several decades. Things expanded, every expanded access to the vote, to the ballot box. These are things that Democrats have wanted for years and years. And Republicans have not. They don't want, you know, an overhaul of the voting system. They don't want the federal government telling municipalities how to conduct their elections. Now, the John Lewis Voting Rights Act, that would resurrect this pre-clearance that was stripped from by the Supreme Court a few years ago, where certain states, before they changed their election laws, they had to get it cleared by the federal government. And that was done in 1965, of course, because of Southern states and the poll taxes and different measures that they had in place to make it harder for black people to vote. Now, the Supreme Court decided a few years ago that this was no longer necessary, that the South had progressed and it was no longer appropriate for the South to have to go through this extra burden of approving how they wanted to conduct their elections with the federal government. And so the John Lewis Voting Rights Act would aim to bring that preclearance back. Well, many Republicans say they don't support either bill. Democrats have tried to say, like Senator Manchin of West Virginia, that he doesn't want to support the For the People Act because it's not bipartisan, but that he wants to focus on the John Lewis Voting Rights Act. But Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell doubling down this week and saying again that he doesn't support the John Lewis bill either.
Yeah, Mark, yesterday, as Eva just said, Mitch McConnell said that, the Voting Rights Act was not struck down. He spoke specifically about this pre-clearance issue. And whether you are a history scholar or not, I think a lot of people are still hearing that the Republicans are not supporting voting rights for people of color. And then behind that, you have dozens of states, particularly this nasty fight in Texas, making it much more difficult for people of color to vote. So, what does this say about where we are?
It says that we are a deeply divided country, and it says that the Republicans, most interestingly, have decided that the way they can win elections in a country whose demographics are changing rapidly is to prevent people from voting or discourage people from voting who they think will vote against them. That is every party in American history has always tried to work their advantage with one group or another, try to get people out to the polls in places where they think they'll do well. But this is a new chapter in that battle in which the Republicans quite cynically are saying, we don't have a message, we are not able to connect with enough Americans to win big elections, and so the only way we can get to the finish line and prevail is to discourage and hold back people from voting. We now have 22 new laws that have been passed in recent months in 14 states that restrict or block or make it easier to challenge people's voting. There are 18 more states where they're considering very similar legislation. So whatever happens in Congress with the For the People Act, the real action, I think, is happening in the states where Republicans are state by state, block by block, creating these obstacles to voting. And this will inevitably end up in the courts. And so the question then will be whether courts will act on a political basis or will act in the tradition of the Voting Rights Act and others that they have upheld in the past that make the right to vote so sacrosanct.
202-319-7810. 202-319-7810. We are at the Reporters Roundtable talking about some of the top stories of the week. If you have a comment or a question, we invite you to give us a call. One of the things that happened 2 days ago is that Vice President Kamala Harris took her first foreign trip as vice president, and she sat down with Lester Holt for an exclusive interview, and he was asking her why she was in Guatemala, for example, but not at the border. And he pressed her, and it seemed as if she got a tad bit flustered by his questioning. Was she prepared, Eva, for this kind of questioning? It seemed to me, from my perspective at least, that she should have been ready for hard questions.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, she's only been vice president a few months. I think it'll get more natural as she continues to grow into this role. Perhaps maybe not, didn't get as many as these tough interviews in her prior, I guess she's been in her long time on the political stage and previously in the Senate, but maybe not at this level before. But yeah, perhaps she should have been a little bit more prepared for this line of questioning. I think that she thinks this argument itself, though, is silly. And even though she thinks it's silly, maybe she shouldn't be expressing that. I think this argument, this question about why hasn't she physically been at the border, I mean, she thinks it's unnecessary. She thinks, well, why do I need to take photo ops at the border? The real conversation and the real focus needs to be looking at examining why people are coming in the first place and addressing those root causes. You know, that's her argument. So she thinks that this entire fixation with her not being at the border is silly. And I think that is sort of what makes for these awkward interactions with the press.
Well, Mark, silly or not, optics matter when it comes to the presidency, the vice presidency. So do you think that maybe this is a learning opportunity for her?
Well, sure. I mean, we have to realize that she's coming into the vice presidency after a short time in the Senate. She has a long and storied political career, but it's been primarily at the local and state level. And she is being entrusted by the president with some really crucial big policy areas, including immigration and the dealings with Central American countries in an attempt to make it harder for or less likely for people to flee those countries and come to the United States. So it's some of this is new material for her, but she's a long-time tough prosecutor. She knows how to think on her feet. She has a long-standing reputation as one of the best questioners in Senate hearings, and so she's someone who is quite facile with switching to new issues. I think this is just a moment where she maybe froze for a second, but there's no question that she has command of the issues, no question that she is a good and tough debater, and so we'll just see how she manages. The larger question is going to be whether she can really make some progress on stemming the tide of immigrants from Central America. That's something that has stymied one administration after another.
Absolutely. This is definitely not going to be a one-off. It is, to your point, Mark, something that is going to be a long-standing problem. But, you know, there's an old saying, you better stay ready so you don't have to get ready. So, so I guess, as I said, this is a learning process. Mark, I want to thank you so much for joining the program, and we hope to see you back here again. We really appreciate your insight on the Inside segment.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Absolutely. We are going to take a break, but don't forget you can hear every edition of the Daily Drum Inside segment via podcast on WHUR.com or download the 96.3 HD2 app on your smartphone and hear the program live in its entirety. If you are on the phone, stay with us. The Daily Drum will continue on Sirius XM channel 141, 96.3 HD2 and 98.3 FM. I'm Harold Fisher. John Mons is next with the original Quiet Storm on WHUR. We'll be back in just a few seconds. Welcome back to The Daily Drum on Sirius XM, channel 141, 96.3 HD2, and 98.3 FM. This is the Insight segment. I'm Harold Fisher. We are at the Reporters Roundtable talking about some of the top stories of the week. My guests are Eva McKend, congressional reporter with Spectrum News. Also joining us now, Misha Green, D.C. editor with the Afro-American Newspapers. Lines are open. Give us a call at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. You are certainly welcome to tweet me at HFisher, WHUR, or find me on Instagram at Harold T. Fisher. Misha, thank you so much for joining the conversation. Good to talk to you again.
Wonderful talking with you again, Harold. Really great to be here. And hello to Mark and Eva. Great to speak with you all today. And I've really enjoyed your insight thus far.
Well, thank you so much. I appreciate the conversation. And I want to get your perspective on that last conversation about Vice President Harris and her interview with Lester Holt. Certainly, she's new to the vice presidency, first foreign trip. From your perspective, is this a learning experience, you know, for her? Should she have been ready? Lester Holt, certainly not someone who is known for biting your head off. He just pressed her a little bit.
You know, I really agree that she must have thought that this conversation about the border itself just was something that we've had before and didn't need to necessarily have again. I mean, of course, the United States has been to the border, which was her point. And as Eva said, must have just thought that it was a silly conversation. I agree with you completely, Harold, that optics absolutely matter. And people are looking at her with, I think, a more critical eye than even vice presidents of the past, her being the first Black and Asian American president, vice president that we've had, the first woman. They're all eyes on her. And so what she may have seen as a waste of time, I think was a moment for her to rise to the occasion in a way that obviously people didn't think she did. And moreover, because sort of her, I suppose, flippant attitude, if you will, it just came off as a bit awkward. But it's absolutely a learning experience. And, you know, she's still new to this. And this is her first foreign trip in this position. And so she'll learn. She has quite some time, I think, to get over this awkward hump, if you will.
Mm. Let's turn our thoughts to what happened in Virginia last night. The Democratic primary, Terry McAuliffe, now back in the Democratic driver's seat and could very well be reelected as governor in the upcoming primary. Certainly a big deal. But the thing that I find most fascinating is that history certainly made last night and could be made again in that two women of color are contending for the lieutenant governor slot. We have Delegate Hala Ayala from Prince William County. She won the nomination over some six rivals, but we also have Winsome Sears, a Black woman who was the first Black woman elected as a Republican delegate in the Commonwealth. She is holding the Republican nomination. Eva, what do you believe this says about what's happening in Virginia?
Well, I think that it shows that, you know, change is slow, but it's certainly starting. It's certainly continuing, and that people want to see folks represented that look like them, that represent them. Women are very politically engaged, and so they should be in these positions of power, right? We're the ones voting. We're the ones doing a lot of the behind-the-scenes efforts to get people out to vote. So it makes sense that the women are ascending to these roles. I think everyone is sort of saying that, oh, okay, well, since Terry McAuliffe cleared this primary, that, of course, he's going to win in Virginia, that is now leaning Democratic or is a heavily Democratic state at this point. But I'm not entirely sure. I'm interested to see what his Republican opponent, Glenn Youngkin, does. I do think that the Black woman in particular that ran against McAuliffe, Jennifer Carroll Foy, and Jennifer McClellan, that they, you know, they have their constituencies, they have people that were excited about them. And I think that McAuliffe will have to do a lot of work to engage all of those voters that voted for his opponents. It was a crowded primary field. And so no one should take his or think that he's just going to ascend easily to the governorship again. I would imagine that this is going to now be a very difficult general election race.
I agree with that. Misha, your thoughts about what's happening in Virginia?
Well, I to answer your question about the two women of color for the lieutenant governor race, I think is really exciting. And as Eva said, it really reflects what the people of Virginia are hoping to see, which is more people who look like them and have their
their particular and intimate needs in mind. But I also think that the people of Virginia are a little sick and tired of the status quo. I was on your show, I guess, a little over a year ago, Harold, talking about the madness, the triple threat, if you will, that was happening in Virginia in terms of the governor, lieutenant governor, and attorney general. And so because of that, I think that, again, you know, obviously McAuliffe won in a really exciting sweep for the Democratic primary. I think he won like 62% of the vote. However, it's not over. It is absolutely not over, because I think the status quo is a little terrifying for Virginians right now.
And honestly, when you look at the broader politics, Virginia, not red, not blue, but it's purple. And even though we have seen, you know, at some of the, you know, in some of the, you know, the top leadership positions, yes, the Democrats definitely in, you know, in control. But when you look at the House of Delegates and you look at, you know, the Senate, you know, Virginia is a big state, and you have a lot of people who are not just, you know, conservative Republicans, but you still have a lot of people there who support Donald Trump, if not in name, in political attitudes. And Youngkin is a Trump supporter, Eva. And so, as you said, this is not a done deal.
No, not at all. And I was actually a little bit surprised. You know, I've learned a little bit about his background. I know that he used to work for the Carlyle Group. He struck me as someone that was a little bit more of a traditional Republican and not someone who was going to lean too deeply into these cultural debates. You know, some of the things that animate Republicans right now, like having fights over transgender kids playing on sports teams, you know, those sort of really hot-button cultural issues. I thought that he would focus more on the economy and sort of the traditional lower taxes, the traditional things that we think of when we think of Republican politics. But then I saw him campaigning with Ted Cruz. So I was like, okay, maybe this is going to be a different kind of a candidate. We will have to see. We'll have to see what he does now that it's going to be a general election. Maybe he will change his strategy a bit now that he has to appear to more people.
But to your point, this is not our parents' Republican Party, okay? And as we have seen, on Capitol Hill, those traditional Republicans who the kind that Joe Biden worked with when he was in the Senate, you know, those folks are gone. Those attitudes are gone. And the Donald Trump legacy continues to spill over, and we now see, you know, less of those fiscal battles, less of those conservative battles, and more of those cultural battles. And I think that we have people like Youngkin who has made that transition to appeal to that sector of the electorate that is still expected to go to the polls in the fall. So I think that's something that we need to look at. One other thing as it relates to Capitol Hill, this new report that was released this week about the January 6th insurrection, talking about security failures. And I'll start with you, Misha. As distressing as it is, and we are still seeing more video beginning to trickle out, is this, have we talked about this ad nauseum, or is this, are we going to just continue to hear more and more and continue to see more and more pushback from the GOP in that they don't want to talk about it?
You know, I think this is not the end of the conversation, and there will be a lot of emphasis from the Democrats and the fact that we must continue the conversation. Of course, the pushback will continue. But at the end of the day, a lot of people, a lot of American citizens are not over January 6th and still quite horrified and have forms of PTSD, if you will, regarding what happened in terms of the insurrection. And so the conversation is not over. Of course, there's a lot of sweeping under the rug happening, and a lot of conversations deflecting from the origins of the insurrection itself, how the people were encouraged to storm the Capitol, et cetera. And I think what's going to happen is that we're going to get a lot of Democratic leaders actually really, really pushing that conversation and saying, no, we cannot ignore this. This is really how it went down. But there's also this report saying that there was a lot of insight and intelligence, at least from high-ranking U.S. Capitol officials and police, that they knew about this. So, you know, unfortunately, I think the conversation is really just beginning to unfold.
Eva, you're on the Hill. What are you hearing, you know, behind the scenes from Democrat and GOP lawmakers about this latest Senate report and where we are right now as it relates to the January 6th insurrection?
Well, I can't emphasize enough how much Republicans just no longer want to have this conversation. They think that this report sort of satisfies, and this kind of work being done at the committee level satisfies all of the sort of investigatory needs that exist, that there does not need to be a special commission. But it's quite alarming, you know, when you read that the intelligence community underestimated the threat, that they saw all of this happening and did not alert the Capitol Police, and that the Defense Department, you know, sort of worried about how they were perceived during earlier demonstrations like the Black Lives Matter protests the prior summer. They really scaled back their deployment after being criticized for their response. So I think that there's a lot to unpack there, but Republicans don't want to have this conversation. They think focusing on January 6th is only going to make them look bad, make the former president look bad. And so they don't want to have this conversation. We'll see how much Speaker Pelosi does, though. The commission vote failed, but she can still put together a select committee. It's unclear at this point if she decides to go that route. The problem is if she does go that route, you know, Republicans across the country, by and large, are not going to trust the results of that investigation. They're going to say it's a partisan investigation. It wasn't bipartisan. And so I think when you have, that's why a commission was so important, a 9/11 style commission, because you wanted information that the whole country can trust. And so it's a difficult road ahead for Speaker Pelosi in determining what she wants to do. She also has to listen to the fallen officers and the officers who died by suicide's families,
yeah,
and what they want from all of this.
Well, I think you make an excellent point. I'm going to take a break, but when we come back, our final issue is something that literally is bugging everybody. 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. We are at the Reporters Roundtable. We'll be back in a moment. Welcome back to the Insight segment on The Daily Drum on Sirius XM, Channel 141, 96.3 HD2 and 98.3 FM. We are at the Reporters Roundtable, continuing with some of the top stories of the week. This may actually be the number two story of the year. This thing is bugging everybody. Cicadas. Every 17 years, these things come out of the ground. They make noise. They mate. But I can't say that I remember it was ever this bad 17 years ago. Eva, do you remember this?
I don't remember it. I would have been in high school.
I wasn't going to mention that, but And Misha, I don't even want to know where you were 17 years ago.
So, but I do remember them really well. I was in middle school.
Oh, God.
I was in middle school, but I remember them very much so, because we know middle school boys and how disgusting they can be. And so they found great pleasure in picking up cicadas and throwing them on the school bus and making the noise behind our ears and things like that to scare the girls in my class, including myself, and make us think that there was a cicada behind us. But I don't remember them showing up on weather radar.
Yeah, on the Doppler system. That's a whole thing.
Yes.
I just think, gosh, in 2004, I was in Baltimore, you know, kind of at the height of my television career, was about to do a whole lot of things that are no longer really relevant in my life right now. But I will say that I just don't remember those little buggy things. I think I vaguely remember there was some discussion about them. And I think, as I think really, really hard, I seem to remember seeing one exoskeleton on my mailbox way back in 2004. But this year seems to be, particularly bad. As you mentioned, Misha, the Doppler radar is detecting them as what I guess the National Weather Service has called a biological event. Our news director, when we were talking about this today, she made reference to that old Alfred Hitchcock movie, The Birds. Now I'm really telling my age, but and that's true. And here's the thing, and it has also happened. Our beloved midday disc jockey or jock, Autumn Joy, she had some fried ones. I thought that she was crazy. And Doug Kammerer over at Channel 4, he was eating them, putting them in tacos. I don't understand what the thing is, Eva, with people eating these things.
Yeah, that's a bridge too far for me. No, thank you. I can deal with the cicadas. I think everyone just needs to calm down. I think it'll be okay. We will survive these cicadas, but just don't ask me to eat them. I'm not eating them. I'm not putting them. People are putting them in smoothies, cupcakes. No, thank you.
Yeah, I actually spoke to Autumn Joy about it, and she said that when they were fried, they had the taste not quite of potato chips, more like pork rinds, but then she said there was a bottom note, kind of like what they say about cologne and perfume. Sorry about that if you're eating dinner, but in the back of the palate kind of situation. And yeah, now Misha, I know that you are a bit of a foodie, so what about you?
You are not going to catch me down on any cicadas anytime soon. And I appreciate that you acknowledge my foodie ways, Harold,
yes,
because you are an amazing cook, and I am always drooling over your food posts and the foods that you're consuming. So, I wondered if you were frying some.
No. Well, first of all, I don't fry because it's not healthy. Although lately I have had a few more fried foods than I'm really comfortable with. But, I haven't. Take my black card if you want. But, I have not fried anything, including chicken, in more than 20 years. It's just too much work for me. Love to eat it, but don't want to cook it. But no cicadas, for me. I mean, look, I don't like bugs in the house. All right. And these nasty things, on the outside. And here's the other thing that I really find fascinating. I saw this on TikTok, is that in some communities, people were complaining that car alarms were going off, and the reality is that those so-called car alarms were the noise that the cicadas were making.
Yeah. Oh, wow.
So that on TikTok.
I'm not surprised. They really are a nuisance. They stopped the White House charter plane from going up with the press because they had taken over the plane and they had to switch planes. And they're a nightmare. But, you know, we'll get through it.
I believe that we will get through it, too. You know, the cicadas in my neighborhood, my neighbors, we see them and we hear them, you know, in the morning. But by late afternoon, you know, they're pretty much gone. Although another friend of mine, we have been kind of joking that there are some cicadas that we still hear. They appear and they're very active after 5. And she said those are the bougie cicadas. She calls them cicadas. So, you know, cicadas during the day, but the more formal cicadas after 5 are the cicadas, the cocktail cicadas. So, look, I think we are going to make it through, and it's good for us to have, you know, somewhat, you know, of a laugh. You know, because it's been a little rough this year, even as we are coming, you know, out of the pandemic, and I'm really looking forward to some better days ahead, hopefully, during the course of this summer. Real quick, before we go, what are you working on for this week, Misha? And same for you, Eve. I'll start with you, Misha.
Oh, thanks for asking, Harold. A lot of great stories in this week's Afro. So, guys, make sure you take a look. In the D.C. section, we're talking about the first-year celebration of Black Lives Matter Plaza. Also, this no-slide zone movement, talking about ending gun violence in the district. We're almost, I think, 20 more homicides from gun violence this year than we were last year. We're talking about the fact that D.C. will be wide open as of Friday. Mm. And looking at a little bit at what the council is doing in terms of the budget hearings right now. Also, it's Black Music Month, and so we are featuring a local but Billboard-charting gospel group who did a wonderful a cappella rendition of Lift Every Voice and Sing. And next week's Afro is actually our special edition, We're Still Here, specifically targeting and focusing on Black music.
Sounds good. Eva, what are you working on this week?
Well, Harold, I'm really focused on the House Budget Committee, Chairman John Yarmuth, Louisville Congressman Chairman John Yarmuth chairs that committee, and I'm looking to see what they do next in terms of Democrats on that committee in terms of coming up with a plan to get this infrastructure through by way of reconciliation. It doesn't look like there's going to be a bipartisan deal on infrastructure. So how are Democrats going to come together? Are they going to be able to come together to get this through another reconciliation effort, which is no easy process?
Yeah, one could only hope. Eva McKend, Misha Green, and of course, we want to thank Mark Fisher from the Washington Post for making an appearance for the first time on this program. Thank you all so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That is the Daily Drum for this Wednesday, June 9th. I'm Harold Fisher. Now stay tuned for Unheard with Wes Hall. Good night.